Well, good morning. I forgot to put the mic on this morning, so always got to forget something. First part of this week, I lost my church keys.
I did.
Yeah, Susan found them about 3 days later. I knew they had to be somewhere unusual that I put them. She found them in Lydia's car seat in her car. So I assume Lydia's been playing with my car keys. Blame it on her, right? We're in the book of Exodus. Back when I was 8 years old, probably 2 years on either side of 8 years old, my parents used to have some good friends. And the man's name was Donald Birchfield. We always call him Donald Mack. Mack was his middle name. Donald Mack Birchfield and his wife, Sandra. And Donald Mack and my dad were friends growing up, about the same age, and they both grew up, both got married, and they still were friends. And so my parents and Donald Mack and his wife used to get together and play Rook. Y'all ever played Rook? Know how to play Rook? They played Rook. I was about 8, my older sister was about 10, and Donald Mack and Sandra had 2 little kids. Their oldest child was a little girl, she was 2 or 3 years old, named Dina. And 3 or 4 years after that, my family moved to Heber Springs. This was in southeast Arkansas. We moved to Heber Springs, and they stayed there. And I never saw Dina again, maybe 2 or 3 times over the next 20 or 30 years. She grew up and married a guy named Tom Burnett. And Tom Burnett was one of the guys on one of the jets that was taken down by on 9/11. In fact, it was the one that they intentionally helped to wreck in the fields in Pennsylvania, I believe it was. Isn't that right? He was on that plane and called his wife a time or two. You may have heard her speak or heard of her from that name, Dina Burnett. And that was her husband. This past week, 9/11 fell into the week, right? And we saw a lot of these memorials that was going on, and I would imagine that it affected her remembrance of that day was brought extremely back in a powerful way to her. And this week on the news or TV or different specific shows that they had or documentaries or memorial services, whatever, you may have seen these two words. And I've heard them now for 18 or 19 years. Never forget. Never forget. What is it? 18 years ago? It's amazing how that seems like yesterday, and there are several, any young man or young woman in here or child under 18 years old or probably under 20 or 21 doesn't even remember that day. And yet, to me, it seems like it was yesterday. How could we forget? How could we forget? That's kind of going to be the theme of our sermon this morning, our text this morning. Never forget. God is leading his people out of Egypt. The Israelites have left Egypt. They have been asked to leave. They've been encouraged to leave. Here, take my gold, take my silver, and leave. And it struck me as I was reading and been reading this text for 2 or 3 weeks now, one of the things that struck me is if they're not in Israel yet. They're not settled down yet. They are on the road, marching. And God gives them these instructions. Now, he will repeat them in perhaps a more refined and more specific way later on in the book of Exodus and certainly in the book of Leviticus and Numbers for sure. But he begins now. Have you ever, and as I was thinking about that, I've thought of this. Have you ever wished that you could have a new beginning? You ever wished that you could start over? You know, Susan and I have discussed that, you know, off and on, just lightly, and I have with other people. If you could go back to when you were 10 years old and live your life again, would you do it? Well, maybe some parts of it, and maybe not, you know. But there are certainly, in all of our lives, there are things we would change if we could. I mean, none of our lives were perfect. But as a whole, you know, I don't think I would. But there are certainly a lot of things I did that I wish I hadn't done. But I wouldn't change my parents. I wouldn't change who I had as parents. I'd just change who they had as a son. Hopefully. But it seems like to me, I had that thought as I was looking at this text. Here they are leaving Egypt. They've been enslaved there for 400 years. And God is carrying them to a place that he has promised them prior to the 400 years even. And they're fixing to start over. They're fixing to start afresh. And God begins to give them some laws. Do you like laws? I'm not really a big fan of laws. I don't mind you have laws. Okay? Why are there so many rules and laws in the book of Exodus? We're fixing to get started on them and probably be on them for the rest of the book. Why are there so many? As we go through the book, I want you to keep this one thought in mind, because we're going to talk about how the laws, you know, are not necessarily applied to us. There are different kinds of laws. There are ceremonial laws. There are civil laws. And there's another kind of law. What kind is it? Ceremonial, civil, moral law. Yeah, that's the one I'm on. And all of them, that's the one I don't like, John. All of them don't apply to us. We know that we're going to talk about all that kind of stuff. But I want you to just keep this thought in your mind, that the principle of the law is for your good. God gives these people laws. And I think, now we talked about the sovereignty of God a couple of weeks ago, and God certainly is sovereign. But I think that God wants the laws for their good. God gives the laws not to make their life hard and difficult, but for their good. Keep that thought in mind the next year or so as we go through this book. We're going to read our text this morning, Exodus chapter 13, verses 1 to 16. Some of it's going to sound familiar, because we've talked a little bit about this in the last week or two. Chapter 13, verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Consecrate to me all the firstborn, whatever opens the womb among the children of Israel, both of man and beast, it is mine." Let those three words sink in. It is mine. Verse 3, and Moses said to the people, "Remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten." We've talked about that before, right? On this day you're going out in the month, Abib. And it shall be when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, this is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from Egypt. It should be as a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand the Lord has brought you out of Egypt. You shall therefore keep this ordinance in its season from year to year. And it shall be when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, as he swore to you and your fathers, and gives it to you, that you shall set apart to the Lord all that opened the womb. That is, every firstborn that comes from an animal which you have, the males shall be the Lord's. But every firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. And if you will not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. And all the firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. So it shall be when your son asks you in the time to come, saying, what is this? That you shall say to him, by strength of hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And it came to pass when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go, the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore I sacrifice to the Lord all males that open the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. It should be as a sign on your hand and as frontlets between your eyes, for by strength of hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt. So there's our text. See on your outline, we've got 4 points. Let's go through them and see what we can discover here. Number one, there are some things in life you need to make sure you never forget. There's some things in life that you need to make sure you never forget. God is setting up a system. He's establishing some things that he wants the Israelites to do. It seems, and I shouldn't say this for the sole purpose. There are, I think, multiple purposes involved here. But at least one of them, he specifically tells us, is so that they will remember, so that they will never forget that God brought them out of Egypt. He says, when your son asks you in that day, what does this mean? You can say, what does this mean, these things we are doing? This feast of unleavened bread, what does that mean? The redeeming of the firstborn, what does that mean? Then you can tell them, this is what it means. You can tell them about, by the strength of God's hand, he brought you out of Egypt when God struck the firstborn of the Egyptians. And God establishes something to constantly remind them, or occasionally remind them, yearly remind them of this event. We do that in some ways. And I've got a question here for you. You give me some answers. What are some things that Christians do to remind us of our Christian faith?
Easter.
That's a good one. Okay, we do certain things on Easter to remind us of the resurrection of Christ. What else? What? Communion. Communion, we've seen that the last couple of weeks, to remind us of the sinless body of Christ and his sacrificial death. What else?
Reading the Bible.
Okay, reading the Bible and the scriptures, we do that partly at least to some extent to remind us of what we have. What else?
Display of the cross.
A display of the cross. The cross reminds us. Does it remind you that? Does it remind you of your faith when you see a cross? You know, you see crosses everywhere, don't you? You see them tattooed on athletes. You see them around the neck on a chain of someone who's involved in some vile, wicked thing, but they've got a cross around their neck. All right? Crosses, it seems, are everywhere, in every shape, in every form. And it's probably very seldom that I see one that it doesn't register in my mind what that means. And a lot of times it's because it's so out of place where it's at, you know, that it reminds me of that. Okay, but a cross. The fish symbol, right? That's one. What's something else?
The rainbow.
Rainbow, that's a good one. All right. Okay, anything else?
Praying hands.
Okay. A dove. Symbol of a dove reminds us of that. What about a wedding ring? Okay, that reminds you of, you know, your vows or whatever to your wife. But if you're a Christian, there's more to it than just marriage. Right? And it's a reminder of that. So there are all these things that we have that remind us to some extent of our faith. Now I've got a follow-up question. How many of these things tend to have lost their meaning to you? They're so common that they it doesn't mean to you specifically what it's supposed to mean. It doesn't register when you see it. Okay, you can go at our home, and I'm sure in a lot of your homes, and you'll see pictures on the walls. A lot of them are, Susan, have cross-stitched, maybe a Bible verse, maybe this or that, but a lot of them have some significance to our Christian faith. They're there. I see them every day. But right now, if you were to ask me what is on the east wall in your living room, I couldn't tell you. I've seen it so much, I don't see it. All right, so sometimes we become accustomed to these things. It's a challenge for us to never forget what God has done for us. Never forget it. Point number two. There are some things in life that you need to make sure you don't neglect. Now, this is a little different than forget. Because neglect kind of leads you with the idea that there's action involved. There's a movement on your part with these things. And this is talking about the firstborn. Let's look at these verses again, verses 1 and 2. God tells Moses, notice what God tells Moses. Consecrate to me. The word consecrate means to set apart. The word holy means to set apart. To take something from the group of common things and take it out of that group. The antonym for holy is not unholy. The antonym for holy is common. Everybody has it. But something is holy, it is taken out of that which might be common and specifically intends it to be for a specific person or a purpose. God said, consecrate to me, set apart to me. What? Your firstborn, whatever opens the womb, the firstborn among the children of Israel, both of man and beast, it is mine. Those three words tell us that God owns something. It is mine. You've all had this experience either with your children or with yourself, maybe even still have it, of where something is mine. And I don't want to share it with you. It is mine. Susan and I were talking this past week. Lydia and Sophie stay with us. Susan keeps them on Fridays. I'm kind of in and out. And so they're at our house on Fridays. Sophie's three, Lydia's one, three and a half, one and a half, something like that. And they play together, they interact together to some extent. But it doesn't take a child, they don't have to be very old, before they understand that concept of it is mine. And the other day, Susan was, we were there at the house, we were kind of watching them. And it's, you see them start to maneuver manipulate circumstances. You see their minds working, manipulating circumstances to get what is not theirs, to mess with somebody else. And Susan and I sit there, and you can see it working, and you know, we try not to laugh. You know, you're wanting to laugh. And we're talking about how that's different for a grandparent than it would be if we were their parent. Okay? With a parent, you've got all these other distractions of the things you got to do. You're doing this, you're doing that, and they're kind of not on their own, but you know, they're kind of, you're not paying that much attention to them. And all this stuff is going on. With a grandparent, you're a little more relaxed. You're a little more low-key. And when they start doing these kind of things, is it funny? You see their sinful nature taking root in their character, and you laugh? Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. It's funny. But this word, three words, it is mine. Who is saying those three words? God. God. It is mine. It is my possession. We should react in a proper way to that truth. Consecrate to me, set apart to me all the firstborn, he says. They're mine. They belong to me. Very briefly, I'll talk about three words. Firstborn, birthright, and first fruits. Okay, these three words are all separate. They are all different. But there is so much interconnectedness, if there is such a word, between these three words that sometimes they're almost used interchangeably. Yeah, they're not quite the same. They're all involved with one another. Firstborn, that's our word that we see here today. It's a place of importance. It's a place of specific purpose. The firstborn. It's being set apart from all the others. That person, the firstborn in the Old Testament scriptures, is expected to receive the birthright. In the New Testament, you'll see this word firstborn used in relation to Christ, being the firstborn among many brethren. It's used in respect to the church. It's used in respect to you as an individual Christian. Romans 8, 29, we saw this word. Whom he did predestinate, he predestinated to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Okay? This is not talking about the first Christian. It's not talking about the most important Christian. It's talking about you are in a place of importance. You have been set apart, that God is going to transform you into the image of His Son. You are special. You are highly important to God. So we see the word firstborn used in that way. The word birthright is related to that, especially in the Old Testament. We see the person who had the birthright was given a double portion of the belongings of the father. You remember Elisha, when he followed Elijah, what did he ask for? A double portion of Elijah's power, Elijah's blessing. He was asking for, as in a sense, the birthright Elijah had as a prophet to be given to him. Right now, that's a symbolic thing there that it seems that he was talking about. The birthright conveyed a sense of responsibility, a sense of authority. I have two siblings. They're both sisters. I've got a sister 2 years older than me, a sister 8 years younger than me. I'm not sure when I began to have this thought, but I was probably, well, first time I had, I probably was 20 or 30 years old. But the older I got, and the older my parents got, the more this thought became on the forefront of my mind. And the responsibility, I began to feel the weight on my shoulders of who is going to take care of my parents. Me? Or my older sister? She's the oldest. Or my younger sister? She ought to be in better shape than me and my older sister, right? Who's going to do it? I never considered those questions. I always felt like it was my responsibility. Now, not because there's a law somewhere in the Bible that says the son has to take care of his parents and not his sisters. I felt that responsibility because I was the son. My sisters had husbands. I was the son. And I felt like it is my place to see that this is taken care of. So with the time I was 50 or so, 45 or 50, that thought was heavy upon me. And Susan and I began to order our life to some extent. We couldn't that much, but to some extent to be able to do that. Now, it was not to get a double portion of my parents' stuff. They didn't have anything. That was not the reason. All right. But it was because there is responsibility there for a child to care for their parents. Are you taking notes, Daniel? The double portion part. Oh. Ain't that right? This firstborn birthright was not always passed on to the oldest son, was it? We remember cases where that was not the case. Jacob and Esau, you think of that. You think of even Cain and Abel. Abel was, actually it was Seth, since Abel was killed. Seth was the one that you might say that responsibility and that the passing on of the spiritual influence of the family went to him, not to Cain. You can see the same thing in Jacob's 12 sons. It did not go to Reuben, who I think was the oldest. Then the third word is first fruits. Literally, this is just, if you have a garden, the first things that come off, the first reaping, the first part of the harvest that you do. If you plant green beans, we had to plant green beans all of mine, Susan's married life, and you get about four pickings off your green beans. The first picking is the first fruits. It's not necessarily the biggest, but it's the first fruits. That could be green beans. It could be oil. It could be grain that the Bible talks about in here. It could be your children. It could be profit from a business. It could be your income. Whatever it is that benefits you physically and materially is first fruits. God talks about that, and that's wrapped up in these things, yet it's distinctly a little separate. There's a verse that I want you to remember. You may know this verse, Proverbs chapter 3, verses 9 and 10. It says, what does it say? I just went blank. Honor the Lord. Honor the Lord with your substance and with the first fruits, there's the word, of all your increase. Okay, so there is the command or the principle or whatever you want to call it. Honor the Lord with your substance and with the first fruits of all your increase. Then he gives a promise. It's a general promise from Proverbs. So shall your barns be filled with plenty, and your presses shall burst out with new wine. This idea, I think, is what God wants for this new nation of Israel that is leaving Egypt and going to Canaan. Honor me with your firstborn. Honor me with your first fruits. Honor me with the birthright that's mixed in there somehow. And as a general rule, you will see this happen. I will bless you. Now, we're not a name it, claim it church. But there is a principle there that if you will live right, if you will honor God with your stuff, generally speaking, things will go well with you. Part of honoring God with your stuff is not, part of honoring God with your stuff is this. I don't honor Him with my stuff so that things go well with me. That's the hard part. If you give to get, you're not giving. Don't neglect these things. All of us are different. All of us have different means. All of us have different resources. Some of us may be able to give because we're financially able to give. But we may not be able as much to serve because we're not physically able to serve. Some of us may not be financially able to give, but we may be physically able to serve. So there's always this flux and this mix of people in a church body. But I want to challenge you to do this. I don't care how poor you are, give. I don't care if it's a dollar, give. Give something, give. I don't care how weak you are. I don't care how bad your knees hurt. Find something that you can do and serve. Some way, sometime, somehow. My dad used to tell an account of a guy who was a ardent tither. He believed in tithing, 10% of his income. And he believed it in this sense, that if I don't do it, God will take it from me. And I think part of what I'm going to tell you is kind of guessing of on my dad's part, but you have to know my dad to kind of know how he was. But he said, if this guy's check each week was $501, his tithe was $50.10. Is that giving? No. It might be doing some mathematical calculations, but it's not giving. Number three. We need to talk about something else here. Richard McDaniel and I were talking before church this morning briefly. Remember 2 weeks ago I made the statement that it doesn't necessarily say that the firstborn was the firstborn son. And I told you I couldn't find where it said that, and if you could find it, let me know. But practically everyone believes that when the 10th plague was in Egypt, The death was upon the firstborn son of Pharaoh and all these things. It didn't specifically say that. Well, in these verses this morning, it doesn't say it either, but it comes perilously close. Okay? Let's look at the instances and see what we see here. Look in verse 12. Or let's look back at verse 11. It shall be when the Lord brings you the land of Canaanites, he swore to you and your fathers and gives it to you, you shall set apart to the Lord all that open the womb, that is, every firstborn that comes from an animal which you have, the males shall be the Lord's. So God is saying, specifically saying, that when you practice this consecration of the firstborn of your animals, it is to be the males. Now, does that mean that it was that way in Egypt during the 10th plague? No. But it sure sounds like it, doesn't it? The implications sure are pointing that way. It goes on, says, but every, verse 13, but every firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. Now, we'll get into that a little later, but it's because the donkey was an unclean animal. If you will not redeem it, you shall break its neck. Y'all can figure that one out. And all the firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. So here he's not talking about animals anymore. He's talking about people. And the firstborn is a son. Now we're not going to sacrifice the son, right? We're not going to kill it on an altar. No. You're going to redeem it. They could offer, we can see, we'll get on into this later on in the book of Exodus, and it's in Leviticus as well. You can substitute and offer other things for this firstborn son to take its place. You redeem it. All right? We'll see later on that this whole idea of the firstborn was redeemed by God, changed it to be the Levites. The Levites became the ones who served in the temple instead of the firstborn. All right, you go on to verse 15. And it came to pass when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go, the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. He doesn't say firstborn sons. He says he killed all the firstborn, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. And this is what you're saying to your sons. Okay? This is what God did. Therefore, when your sons are talking to your sons, therefore I sacrifice to the Lord all males that open the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. Now it doesn't specifically say that the firstborn in Egypt were sons. It does specifically say that in the future, when you practice this, it will be sons, it will be males. But the idea that they were males in Egypt is extremely strong. Okay, so we'll leave that there. Point number three. There are some expressions of religion that you need to make sure that you don't practice improperly. There are some expressions of religion that you need to make sure that you don't practice improperly. Now, we've already talked about the leaven. I think John talked about this to some extent. So we're not going to go into that very much, but that's the what I want to talk about on this idea. When the children of Israel left Egypt, they left with unleavened bread. And it tells us, I think I've got the reference down here, Exodus chapter 12, verse 39. It gives a reason, a literal reason, that they left with unleavened bread. You know, God has different reasons and different purposes in mind for one event. He may have two or three things he wants to teach you from that. But one of the reasons, this verse tells us they left Egypt with their bread unleavened, was because they were in a hurry. They did not have time to let it rise. Okay, that's the reason that's given in that verse. When we read these verses in our text today, I don't see any mention of that fact. In fact, you look in verse 7, it says, unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you. Don't let us see any leavened bread, nor shall leaven be seen in your house or your quarters. They went to great effort to make sure all the leaven was out of the house when they practiced this feast. What does that have to do with being in a hurry leaving Egypt? I don't know. I don't see any connection at all. But this feast of unleavened bread, which the unleavened began with that idea that they were in a hurry when they left, is now other things are added to it. God added them to it. Don't have any leaven in your whole house. Get it out. So what's this mean? There are some symbolic lessons here that practically every commentator will tell you about, and I'm not disputing those things at all. But one is this, that leaven represents corruption. When you have Susan makes homemade rolls occasionally. Susan's not in here, but Tina makes good rolls too, homemade rolls. When you make homemade rolls, and Susan's making them, she's in the house, she's got it, you know, before it rises, dough. All right, it's sitting there. It's got some yeast in it. And she'll tell me, she'll come and ask, she may have them sitting, if it's summertime, on the back screen and back porch where it's kind of warm. She may put them in the oven with it barely warm. I don't know how, you know, what she determines where to put it, but I think it's got to be a kind of a warm place. But almost invariably, she will tell me this. Don't bump it. Don't touch it. Don't even think about them. Don't look at them. Nothing. Why is that? Because he's afraid they will fall, whatever that means. All right? It has something to do with that yeast. That yeast spreading and inside that dough and corrupting the whole bowl of dough. It's said to represent sin. It's said to represent a total separation from Egypt. Egypt in the Bible sometimes pictures sin, a place of sin, a place of corruption. And when the Israelites came out of there, the picture is one of leaving sin, totally getting out. And that perhaps is the idea here. You see that analogy in the New Testament. 1 Corinthians talks about a little leaven leavens what? The whole lump. All right, you see a similar thought in the book of Galatians. Now here's the thing that I want to give you a thought here. There are a lot of people in the world. People are different. I'm different than you, and you're glad you're different than me. Right? We're different. Some people want to find them something that they can hang on to, that they can do. And they want to find something that they can follow to make them feel good about their righteousness. And so you'll find groups that will pick something out of the Old Testament, and they can do it, and they'll hang on to it, hang their hat on it, and by golly, that's their salvation. They can keep that law. I remember years ago, I was a music director in a church that we were in, and this new guy came to church, and he was a little different. And one Sunday morning, he came to me before church and says, "How are we going to celebrate the Feast of the Trumpets today?" And that's what I did. I kind of chuckled. And I said, "I don't have a clue. I didn't know it was the Feast of the Trumpets." And I wasn't making fun of the guy, but it just caught me so off guard that I couldn't have a good response. But he wanted to keep the Feast of the Trumpets. There are all kinds of groups out there that focus in on this one thing or that one thing. If God were to tell you, we're going to make a list of laws that you've got to keep, that everybody's got to keep, and you get a chance to pick one of them, what would you pick? You're going to have to, he's going to give you 2 or 3 days to think about it. You're going to pick a law that everybody in the church has got to keep. Let me tell you what you would pick. Something you don't want to do anyway. Something you could do. Something you could keep. I'll tell you what I would pick, and I'm not getting on to anybody here. I don't believe gambling is a horrible sin. Okay? That I have never gambled in my life. I've never bought a lottery ticket. I've never played bingo for money. I've never played poker. I've never done any of that stuff. Never. It's not because I'm such a disciplined person. I've never done it for the same reason my dog won't eat Jell-O. It's disgusting to him. I have no interest in it. So if we're going to make laws, I might make that one. Because I won't have any problem keeping that one. It's much easier to outwardly conform to some rule than it is to keep the spirit of that law. Keeping the spirit of a law is tough. It is really tough. Jesus said, "You have heard it said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery." There's lots of men and women who have never committed adultery. But I say unto you, whoever looks upon a woman to lust after her in his heart, and now the crowd thins out, doesn't it? It's one thing to keep the letter. It's another to keep the spirit. We are to live our lives keeping the spirit of the law. It involves much more than getting the leaven out of your house. It goes much deeper than that. Number four. There are some instances in life when God takes possession of his property. We saw that first verse. Consecrate to me all the firstborn. They are mine. They are God's possessions. Do you look at your life that way? That there are certain things in your home or your life that belong to God? In a way, I hope not. Because everything belongs to God, doesn't it? Everything belongs to God. We believe that. We say that. I believe that. I say that. I remember when our first son was born, our first child, when Mark was born. I remember holding him. And I can remember talking to God and saying, "God, he is yours. He belongs to you. He is yours. Here's what I want for him. Here's what I wish I could see him become. But he's yours." Have you ever done something similar to that with your kids? I imagine a lot of you have with your kids. What if God were to say, "Okay, I think I'll take him"? Thanks, I'll take him. That doesn't mean God is doing away with him, although God could. God's taking him from our presence. Is that what I wanted? No. Not at all. No. God is still God. He is still the Lord, the sovereign Lord of all of life, of everything that I have. I acknowledge to him that my firstborn is his. I acknowledge to him that everything that I have is his. Let's live our lives with that thought, with that mentality. they are the Lord's. Let's pray.